Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. We just celebrated Vesak when we remember the birth, enlightenment and parinibbana, or passing away completely, of Lord Buddha. And I'd like to talk tonight a little bit about the Dharma. The Dharma is both the teaching given by the Buddha, and also refers, when it's used with the small d, to phenomena, to anything that arises. And particularly when we talk about the Dharma with a big D, we're talking about the teachings which the Buddha gave to explain the truth and to give instructions that we could follow to also practice for our realization of the truth and our liberation from suffering. And when we chant our respect and reverence for the Dharma, we say that the Dharma is svākhāto, that it is perfectly expounded. In the Pali language that we chant in, svākhāto means that it's perfectly taught, perfectly given or elaborated on. And this perfection comes from the fact that the Buddha accurately described reality in all its forms. And not only did he describe it accurately, but he described it in a way that people like us could understand and make an entrance into that understanding of truth. It's not just perfect because the enlightened ones can all agree with it, but because it's given in a way, the instructions, practices, in a way that we can access that truth. And of course, we have to put into practice the teachings, not just accept them because we have confidence in the teaching or we think that we agree with what the Buddha says. We have to put them into practice. And that's the quality of the Buddha, of the Dharma, sorry, where the Buddha says that it is inviting, it is apparent here and now. It doesn't have to depend on a certain time to realize the results or to see the truth that the Buddha is pointing to in his teachings. In the way that we described the Dharma, we say that the truth was in the time of the Buddha and it's true in the same way right now. His teachings weren't a theory. They weren't something that was his construct. He was describing reality. And what was reality then is reality now. And that's why the teaching is so relevant to us now, because it describes life as we live it, as we know it now, in the same way that it was lived in the time of the Buddha. We might think many things have changed since that time, but the basic facts of life. Birth, aging, sickness, death, the nature of the mind, the relationship between the mind and the body, the relationship between the mind and reality. These things are the same. And we can see those things right now for ourselves if we practice according to the instructions. And we don't have to wait until we die to get the results. Happiness in heaven. The results are available right here and now, according to our understanding. That much there will be freedom, freedom in the mind, peace in the heart, and that can be experienced directly in this life right now. And this teaching is, if you like, holding out the carrot that it is possible to live a full life, full in the sense of experiencing the ups and downs of life, anything that life has to throw at us, and still have joy in the heart. The Buddha invites us to come and see, to come and find out for ourselves. And if we practice and we follow the instructions, it's possible for the wise to know these truths, each for themselves. This is what we chant when we're chanting our respect to the Dharma, that this Dharma is available right here and now, and the results are available right here and now. So when we try to apply these teachings and see that they are relevant right here and now, they especially apply to the understanding of the mind and how the mind works, and how, by understanding how the mind works, we can practice to overcome suffering and to develop a feeling of well-being and being at ease with life, even when things are a challenge. Part of this understanding is the theory that we hear about the mind, but so much of it comes from our own practice, and particularly our practice in meditation. So tonight, when we were doing our meditation practice, I was trying to introduce you to, or help you to see, if you've already had some teaching, the nature of the mind as that which knows objects, which is capable of knowing objects. That is what the mind is. The mind is something that we can't touch or see or measure in size. We only know the mind when it is aware of objects and when it's active in relation to phenomena. And those phenomena or objects of the senses are the things that we can know through the sense doors, through the eye door which sees, through the ear door which hears, through the tongue door which tastes, through the nose door which smells, through the body door which feels touch, and the mind door which has images, ideas and thoughts, memories and feelings. These are all objects that can be known. And when we first start to practice, and if we haven't practiced at all, so much of our energy and our attention and our life is spent, absorbed in the objects of the world, the objects of the mind, the things out there that we take as separate from us or distinct from us, but which we bring into our world through hearing them, seeing them, smelling them, tasting them, touching them, thinking about them. Once we engage with them, we have the sense that those objects are me, that they belong to me, that I am those things. I am this taste. I am this memory. I am this thought. I am this sound that I'm hearing right now. And in a sense, that's true. But in another sense, the fact that we can know them as objects shows us that there's another part to the mind, the part that is aware of these things, the things that are coming in and out of our experience. These are objects that can be known. And when we know them by observing them, we see that they're impermanent. They come and they go. They arise according to causes and conditions. Very often those causes and conditions are out of our control, and it's just happening whether we want it or not. So even as we were sitting here and focusing on the breath, for example, hearing was still happening. There was still the awareness of sounds in the environment, even if we weren't consciously hearing, consciously listening to those sounds. The fact that they were happening in the environment, the fact that the ear is working, the fact that awareness is happening means that hearing is taking place whether we like it or not, even though we are primarily focusing on the breath. These are causes and conditions that are creating our experience in any moment. And when we focus on the external causes and conditions, and we make that our world, and we try to control that world in order to be happy, in order to feel safe and secure, in order to have the way things the way we want them, then we are really fighting a losing battle, because those objects will always be changing. Sometimes they'll be changing according to our likes, but very often they will be doing their own thing and sharing the environment with us. They become part of our world when we come in contact with them. They don't even have to be in our physical space. They can be an idea that we have about something that's happening on the other side of the world. But they come into our space and they affect the way we feel. So if we focus on the objects and hope to create our life around the objects, our happiness around the objects, our security around the objects, then sometimes we'll be successful and sometimes we won't be. So the path of practice involves gradually developing that understanding of how the mind is what knows objects, and these things that we know are objects. But there is also the mind that simply knows. And when we put our attention on that aspect of our experience, we can see that that part of the mind or that part of our experience is an aspect that we can work with to start to develop and cultivate a mind which knows with wisdom and knows with loving kindness, knows with compassion, knows with equanimity, and is able to remain stable and steady through the changes that take place in the objects that create our world. The mind that knows is also arising and passing away, and it is also a conditioned phenomenon, just like all the other objects. And when we turn our attention to the awareness, it becomes an object of the mind. So when we turn to look at the mind, and I gave the analogy of turning the camera back to look at the one who's taking the picture rather than the one that's you're taking the picture of, then we see that this awareness is already coloured. It's already got other things added to it, even as it is looking at the objects that it's paying attention to. So it's listening to a sound with the feeling perhaps of irritation already. It's listening to a sound with an idea that that sound is bad. It's listening to a sound perhaps with a feeling of, I like that, I want it. Now when these things are present in the mind that's aware, the mind that's observing, we start to sift out, censor out what's going on in our world according to our likes and dislikes. We don't see the whole picture. We may fixate on the things that we don't like and don't see the good parts. We may fixate on things that we like and don't see the things that we don't like, the other qualities we don't, or the other objects that are present. The mind that's aware is already coloured. And so we are turning our attention to that awareness so that we can see more clearly what we are bringing to this moment. Just by seeing it already starts to give us more power or more control over this moment. Because instead of acting just habitually or unconsciously, we start to act with full awareness. Because we start to get to know what's going on, and also to see what's in the mind, how that adds on something to the objects that we are watching, that we're aware of, that are coming into our awareness, our sphere of awareness. What we're adding on, whether it's helpful or not. Becoming aware of the mind that's watching. we practice, we develop as a skill in our meditation. When we become skillful at it in our meditation, then we can take this kind of skill out into our daily life. In our daily life, things are happening so quickly and so repetitively that we don't have time very often to actually observe the mind that's doing the watching or doing the interacting or taking up objects. And so we don't recognize what we're already bringing to the situation and maybe helping the situation if we have loving kindness in the mind, or making the situation worse if we're bringing greed or anger to the situation. So this waking up to what's going on in the mind is following the Buddha's invitation to come and see what is happening here and now in this present moment, to be known right now. It can be known right now. It's apparent here and now. And the more that we start to see it, and the more we develop that ability to look, and to look even if we don't like what we see, the more we will be able to control the mind. And this is where we find our power, and this is where we find our freedom. Our freedom can't be found in the objects. Our power can't be found in the objects. Freedom and the power can only be found in the mind that knows, and that starts to understand the laws of nature and the way things work, that really understands impermanence, really understands cause and effect, really understands how attachment, hanging on, trying to control actually leads to suffering. So when the Buddha invited us to come and see, he was inviting us to look into our own mind. And we can use an investigation of the body, our own body, as a way of also seeing these laws of impermanence, cause and effect, lack of control, things happening according to their own nature. So the mind that knows the body becomes an object for our awareness. Now we can look on the body in the same way as any other object. We can look on it with aversion. We might look on it with aversion when it's painful, when it's sick, when it's old, when it hurts, when it's cold, when it's too hot. We might look on it with greed, when we want it to be a certain way, to look a certain way, to feel a certain way. When we look on it as me. So what we're trying to do through all of these practices is just to be aware of the object as it is, and then of the mind that is aware of the object. So is there greed present in the mind when we're looking at that? Is there aversion present in the mind when we're looking at that? Is there worry? Is there fear? Is there lust? What is in the mind that's doing the looking? We keep on turning the camera back on the mind that's taking the picture, if you like, the one that's observing. And when we start to see what is acted in, and when we start to see the result of that, then with wisdom we discern what is for our well-being and what is for our suffering. This kind of practice is called, in some schools, vipassana practice, the practice of trying to see directly. But it's very difficult to do this kind of work unless there is some clarity, some tranquility, and some peace in the mind that gives the mind the strength and the willingness to look and to look at things that we don't like to see. If we have the attitude of not wanting to see, then we won't see. We will constantly delude ourselves, look away, and pretend. It's very clear how we pretend knowingly and unknowingly about that this body is mine, that this body does what I tell it to do, and to some extent that's right. But none of us can control this body so that it doesn't get sick, that it doesn't get old, that it won't die. We delude ourselves, and it's not that there's no way of understanding these things and waking up to them. The evidence is all around us, but we don't look for it. We don't take it in when it's right in front of our eyes. We refuse to see it. This is delusion. And that's the other defilement of the mind that makes it very difficult for us to see clearly. And it's the delusion that keeps us looking outwards, putting all our faith in the objects of the world as the source of our happiness, source of our security, the way that we're going to produce the conditions that will make us happy, successful, secure. It's very hard to see that delusion, and this is the beauty of the Buddha's teaching. Why the Buddha's teaching is perfect, because it's describing something that is there, but that which we fail to see. The Buddha's teaching isn't manufacturing anything that doesn't exist. It's just pointing out the reality so that those with eyes can see. One time someone asked the Buddha, how can you say that the teaching is visible here and now? What is an example? And the Buddha said to that person, can you know if greed is present in the mind? Can you know if aversion is present in the mind? Then that is the Dharma visible here and now. When you see that that is present in the mind and you experience it, to know that experience is the Dharma. And to know the mind that is free of aversion, free of greed, is also the Dharma. It's not the object, it's the knowing that is the deeper Dharma. Knowing and being able to hold that aversion or hold that greed as an object of the mind means that we don't have to go along with it. We don't have to believe it. We don't have to identify with it. We don't have to do it. When we don't realize it's something that can be known, and there is a part of the mind that is knowing that is different from that greed, from that aversion, then we immediately just believe it. We immediately identify with it. Comes into the mind and we have to do it. When we can know it, then it isn't all of who we are at that moment. We don't have to believe it. We don't have to do it. And we don't have to suffer the consequences. So the Buddha said, this is the Dharma, and this is the benefit of the Dharma that is visible here and now and can be experienced for the wise, by the wise right at this moment. Further, if we not only know that these things are present and we know the consequences of them and we refrain from acting on them because we understand the detrimental effects, or we understand that this isn't me, this isn't all of who I am, I don't have to act on this. This wisdom is the Dharma. And as we develop this wisdom and make it grow, we are overcoming delusion. We overcome delusion by developing wisdom. We develop wisdom by seeing clearly. The awareness has to lead us on to seeing clearly, understanding what's going on, and experiencing it directly makes it our own inside wisdom. And then it becomes something that we can use in our life. And we can use it whether we're in meditation, whether we're in daily life, whether we're with our Dharma friends, or whether we're in a situation where there isn't anyone else who knows what we're doing. We ourselves are responsible for what we're doing, and we're able to carry it out wherever we are. This is when we know that the wisdom is our own. So getting these results in the present moment, taking them with us into the next moment, makes them grow. The more that we can grow them, even if it's just for a time, even if it's just in episodes of our life, helps this quality of wisdom to grow. And then the wisdom starts to counteract the greed, the hatred, and the delusion. Until the counteracting force of that wisdom is there, we need to support the mind by doing the samatha practices, the practices which calm the mind and give the mind the strength to restrain itself even when it doesn't see clearly. The samatha practices, like watching the breath, practicing loving kindness, keeping precepts, cultivating wholesome qualities like truthfulness, generosity, all of these are practices which may not help us to see directly with insight, but they give the mind enough breathing space until that insight is developed. And without that breathing space, it's really difficult just to rely on being able to see clearly. It's just very, very difficult because our habit patterns are so strong. the mind moves so quickly, it's very hard to catch what's going on until it's all over. It's too late. So these samatha practices are really indispensable if we are going to develop the full repertoire of skills that the Buddha said are available to us and which we need to do the work. So another time someone asked the Buddha, how do we use the Dharma in a way which makes our practice secure? And the Buddha said, when we get into a difficult situation and we don't know what to do, we don't know through our direct experience how to handle this situation, if we call to mind at that time the truth of the Dharma and the fact that it is perfectly expounded, not only because it is the truth and describes reality, but because it gives us access to that truth and to a practice which takes us to freedom. Just the recollection of the Dharma in that moment gives the mind the breathing space that it needs. It fills the mind at that time with a wholesome thought. And if we have benefited from the truth, from the Dharma, from the Buddha's teaching, if we have a connection through faith, through our direct experience, then the recognition, the remembrance of the Dharma as, if you like, our life raft will not only fill the mind with something positive, but it will help us to find the confidence in that moment to tackle a situation which we find challenging. We don't know what to do. We don't know what to say. We can't think of the right answer, but we know that we don't want to follow our old habit patterns. And so we give ourselves the breathing space not to do anything by just bringing to mind the wonder, the grandeur, the beauty of the Dharma. And we take refuge in the Dharma in that moment. And the Buddha said this is the way of giving oneself the opportunity to refrain from doing what is unskillful and to cultivate the good. So the more that we develop our understanding of Dharma through our own practice, the easier it will be to bring that into our mind when we need it, and the more strength and power that we'll have to reassure us that there is a way of dealing with this situation, even if we can't remember it or find it or bring it up or feel able to do it at this moment itself. With that breathing space, with that reaffirming our connection to Dharma, we may just find that we are able to break the charge or the flow of our habit pattern long enough to bring to mind something different, doing something that is more skillful than we have been able to do in the past. So these are two ways in which the Buddha himself talked about the Dharma as being available to us here and now, visible in this moment. The fact that we're able to be aware of the objects in our mind, even if those objects are thoughts, emotions, feelings, which previously we've identified with, gotten lost in, been overwhelmed by. We develop the ability to see them as something not other than who we are, but not the whole of who we are. And then as that connection with Dharma strengthens, we can bring the Dharma into mind as our refuge right on the spot. And that can give us the help we need to get through those difficult times. So when we're practicing our meditation, I encourage you, as you focus in on the objects, like the breath or like sounds or whatever, that you also take time to develop the skill of turning your attention towards the mind that is knowing. What is the colour of the mind? What is present in the mind? What is the attitude that I'm bringing? What is the awareness like that is knowing this object? This is where we can develop not only wisdom, understanding, but deep peace and equanimity, so that we don't lose the balance of the mind in difficult times, and so we really can start to see things as they really are without the coloration that we usually bring to our experience. So may this teaching be a benefit to all of us, and may the fact that we've come together and that we've made the effort to practice and listen to this teaching, may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. Are there any questions or comments? Yes? Yes, so the question is, looking at the colour of the mind and what the quality of the awareness, and knowing that and not identifying with the content of the object or of what's the colour of the mind, not identifying with it, would that be like the unawakened experience? Yes, that's moving towards the awakened experience. The awakened experience, when there's true insight, the coloration that goes with each moment of awareness is wholesome in that it is free of defilements and also free of delusion. That's really the freedom there. And then not to identify with any aspect of it. That's also the freedom of wisdom.